and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we're very pleased to have Yuma Totani on the show, and we'll be talking about her new book, The Tokyo War Crimes Trial, The Pursuit of Justice in the Wake of World War II. You've probably heard of the Nuremberg Trials, and you can probably even name some of the people accused and convicted. And you may have heard of the Tokyo War Crimes Trials, but perhaps not. I knew that they had occurred, but I didn't really know anything about them until I read Yuma's really terrific book. Well, they did occur, and they were important in a number of senses, one of which is that it helped the Japanese people come to terms with what their government and military had done during the Second World War, and also the trials set a number of international precedents that are still in force today. The interpretation that she gives of the trials is also very engaging. It seems that the Americans and their Confederates bungled the trials pretty badly. I'll let her explain in the interview. Here it is. Hi, Yuma.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
Very well, thank you.
You are in Hawaii, is that right?
That's correct, yes.
Wow, that must be very nice.
It is indeed. You can't hope for the better.
I think this is perfect. I think that's right. I'm here in Iowa, and we're having a beautiful day today, but I think it's our first one. And I visited Hawaii, and pretty much every day is beautiful.
That's so right, yes.
You're very lucky to be there. You can please invite me to come give a talk or something.
Sure. That'll be good.
Yeah, I should tell our listeners that we're talking to Yuma Totani today, and we'll be discussing her new book, The Tokyo War Crimes Trial, The Pursuit of Justice in the Wake of World War II. I've read the book, obviously, and I think it's terrific. It fills a great lacuna in my knowledge. I knew a lot about the trials that took place in post-war Germany, the Nuremberg trials of great fame, but Americans and I think people in general don't really know as much about the Tokyo War Crimes trial, so we should thank Yuma very much for writing this terrific book. Let me begin, Yuma, by asking you to say a few words about yourself, that is where you grew up and where you went to school and how you became interested in this topic.
Sure. I was born and raised in Japan, and I went to a university in Tokyo. It's a university called the International Christian University.
Mm-hmm.
I studied art history.
Mm-hmm.
And graduated in 1995, yes. Afterwards, with my parents' generous financial support, I had an opportunity to study abroad.
Mm-hmm.
I went to England. I studied for a master's degree for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
I was at the School of Oriental and African Studies.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of the University of London
mm-hmm.
system.
Mm-hmm.
There I studied political science.
Mm-hmm.
We did a lot of comparative studies of the formation of modern states in Asia and Africa.
Mm-hmm.
After that, I decided that I actually wanted to do some work on Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And my advisors at SOAS told me that if I were to study something on Japan, I should go to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Strangely enough, they didn't suggest that I go back to Japan. So I ended up applying for various universities in the United States. Got accepted at the University of California at Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
And there I started taking various courses on Japan and some other history courses.
Mm-hmm.
Over the course of my graduate training there, I thought that maybe I wanted to do something else, in fact. So I was taking other courses on Africa again, and South Asia, which became part of my research interests while I was in England,
mm-hmm.
and also while I was at UC Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
So my teachers were a little worried about my drifting off,
mm-hmm.
But I managed to stay on to studying history of Japan. Largely due to my finding this very interesting topic, the Tokyo War Crimes Trial.
Mm-hmm.
I stuck to that topic,
mm-hmm.
and then Yeah, and I got my PhD just about 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Ever since I've been teaching, I was first at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
I taught there for 3 years, and now I'm based in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Your story sounds a little bit like my story, and I think every professional historian's story. That is, you get to graduate school, and then you wonder what you're doing there.
That's right.
Because it does take a long time. That's certainly the case. And also, I liked what you said about your parents' generous financial support. I think that everyone I interview should say that, but they don't.
Uh-huh.
So I know my mom.
I think, sure. I think Japanese parents actually, a lot of them are really generous about
mm-hmm.
Children's education,
mm-hmm.
far more so than, say, I don't know the situation in the United States, but a lot of students do get parental funding for the undergraduate education,
mm-hmm.
And to some extent for the graduate
mm-hmm.
education.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I should have got it. I should have earned my living myself, but since my parents offered, I took it.
I don't blame you for a second. Nobody would. And we're glad that you persisted, and were able to write this terrific book. Let's begin to talk about the book a little bit, and I want to
sure.
I want to start with a question, which you may or may not have expected. But as someone who grew up in Japan, what did you know about the Tokyo war crimes trial before you started this research?
That's a good question. I was aware that there are a lot of debates about the war, how the Japanese people should confront the past and
mm-hmm.
accept war guilt. But I wasn't quite aware how the Tokyo war crimes trial figured in the this larger debate.
Mm-hmm.
Or for that matter, I wasn't really interested
mm-hmm.
in the Tokyo trial and wasn't really paying much attention to this ongoing debate about the war and responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't
know very much about it. Let me ask a follow-up question. Do Japanese people know very much about it?
Yes, that's I would say yes. I would say up to my generation, or perhaps a generation earlier, almost every person would have something to say about the Tokyo trial.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was such an important historical event in terms of understanding the Japanese involvement in World War II.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I was going to ask, what do people say about it? What are the various positions people take about it?
The general understanding of the Tokyo trial among the Japanese people was that it was a politicized event.
Mm-hmm.
And that, legally speaking, there was little or nothing valid
mm-hmm.
in the findings of the Tokyo Tribunal.
Mm-hmm.
That's the general understanding.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see. So it was a rather brave thing for you to write this book then. Did you ask your friends back and family members back in Japan whether this was an appropriate topic?
I didn't do that. My parents don't really mind. They don't really care what I do. As long as I'm happy, they're
mm-hmm.
happy about it. While I was doing my research, people would ask me questions about the Tokyo trial. But when they're asking me questions, they're actually not interested in what I had to say. They rather wanted to tell me what they thought the Tokyo trial was about.
Isn't it always so, that way, though?
Yes, but it was difficult for me to deal with these people because I understood what they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And while I didn't quite understand, I didn't have a full grasp of the Tokyo trial when
mm-hmm.
When I was having all kinds of conversation with
mm-hmm.
these people. That was when I was doing my research.
Mm-hmm.
So I was often finding myself at a loss.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought I should continue
mm-hmm.
because I could see there's so much interest in this topic,
mm-hmm.
At least among the Japanese people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I suspect there's a lot of interest among Americans and Europeans as well. I know that, like I say, I looked through the catalog of Harvard University Press, and this book jumped right out at me because I knew it was a huge gap in what I understood. So, again, thanks for writing the book. Is it going to be translated into Japanese?
It has been translated.
Oh, great. Mm-hmm.
In fact, I did the translation myself, which was really great because I didn't have to consult the author as to rewriting and making addition. And I had to make a lot of change because the audience, the readers, the Japanese version is addressing to us is so radically different from the audience I expected when I wrote this first in English.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, I see. So what sort of changes did you make?
I removed some basic information about the Tokyo trial that the Japanese people may already know.
I see. Mm-hmm.
I also tried to expand on some aspects of the trial that are of special interest for the Japanese, especially where it concerned the treatment of Judge Powell, who is an Indian judge and one of the 11 members of the Tokyo Tribunal.
Mm-hmm.
We may get to him later on, but he wrote a dissenting opinion. Which rejected almost all findings made by the majority opinion. Ever since his dissenting opinion became known, the Japanese people rallied around it and elevated to treated it as the authoritative judgment, as opposed to the majority judgment being the Victor's politicized opinion.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to expand on how things have been discussed about this dissenting opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to give updated information about the Japanese scholarship on him and the implication of his dissenting opinion to the Japanese government's position regarding the continuing international effort in international prosecution today.
I see. That's interesting. It's interesting that it would have to be adjusted for the audience in that way, and I can understand how it would be. Has the Japanese translation come out yet in Japan?
It came out 4 months after the English version came.
I see. How is it received?
It's been received very well.
Oh, great.
Thanks. Thanks in part to my publisher in Japan. Mrs. Shobo is my publisher. But again, there is just such a huge interest in the Tokyo trial that the response was immediate. It came out in August 2008. The following month, there was already a book review in the Nikkei, which is a major financial newspaper in Japan. Followed by a few more book reviews in other major national papers. And the sales of my book, the record of it is much better in Japan than in the United States.
I bet, yeah, no.
So, and this is interesting given the fact that the Japanese version is priced much higher than one. It's about $55.
Really?
Yeah, so as an academic book, it's quite cheap. Usually it's like more than $60, between $60 and $100, something like that. But still for ordinary, you know, lay people, it's an expensive book. So it's not just my book that's selling well. There are dozens of other books on the Tokyo trial that came out last year
in
Japan.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yes, because 2008 marked the 60th anniversary of the Tokyo judgment. So Japanese publishers tried to get a book out on the Tokyo trial to to meet this anniversary.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure there are other books that are equally selling very well last year.
Have you had the opportunity to make any radio appearances or television appearances to talk about the book?
No, this is the first one.
Oh, really? That's surprising
to me.
Yeah, I would suspect.
I'm very honored.
Yeah, oh, certainly. My pleasure, absolutely. But I would have expected that the Japanese media would have been very interested in talking to you. But if any of them are listening, I encourage them to call you.
Sure.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the book itself. The first question I have is, why did the Allied powers decide to proceed with a Nuremberg-like trial in Japan after the war?
The major goal of the trial at Nuremberg, the international one, was to establish the responsibility of the German Nazi leaders for the planning and waging of aggressive war.
Mm-hmm.
That was really the centerpiece of the prosecutorial effort at Nuremberg.
Mm-hmm.
To try the same group of Nazi leaders for other types of international offense, such as war crimes
mm-hmm.
and crimes against humanity,
mm-hmm.
Was also important.
Mm-hmm.
But to establish a new legal precedent that determined the criminality of aggressive war
mm-hmm.
and that determined individual criminal responsibility for such act. That these two were the main issue at the international, this ad hoc international tribunal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so did they say that they wanted to apply this precedent then to the Japanese case?
Yes, that's how the Tokyo tribunal was conceived, really.
Mm-hmm.
That is, the Allied powers already had the plan to hold a series of international trials in the Far East.
Mm-hmm.
But to they also made a specific decision that there will be another international prosecutorial effort
mm-hmm.
in the Pacific, and that its focus will be the prosecution of wartime Japanese leaders for the crime of aggression,
mm-hmm.
or then known as crimes against peace.
Mm-hmm, exactly. I want you to just to say a few words, if you will, about the three kinds of charges or the three general areas that the Allies pursued in their prosecution against the Japanese. And those are, because I don't think our listeners will understand exactly what they are, having not read the book. That is crimes against peace.
Mm-hmm.
That's one. War crimes is two. And then the one that they'll all know about, which is crimes against humanity. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the difference between those.
Yes. Crimes against peace are the acts of planning, preparing, initiating, and waging aggressive war.
Mm-hmm.
These acts, committing any of these acts, or the conspiring to commit these acts
mm-hmm.
constituted crimes against peace.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it was defined in the statute or
mm-hmm.
the charter of the Nuremberg Tribunal
mm-hmm.
and as well as in the charter of the Tokyo Tribunal.
Mm-hmm.
War crimes are such crimes that are committed in violation of rules and customs of war.
Mm-hmm.
As of today, there are the key international documents regarding rules and customs of war. When we talk about it, we go back to the Geneva Conventions of 1949,
mm-hmm.
but among other things.
Mm-hmm.
But the international agreements that applied at the time of World War II go back to those conventions concluded before 1930.
Mm-hmm.
So the major ones include the Hague Convention
mm-hmm.
of 1907
mm-hmm.
and the Geneva Convention
mm-hmm.
of the of 1929.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's war crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a crimes. There are a variety of acts that would come under the category of war crimes, but they are mainly criminal conduct committed against the prisoners of war,
mm-hmm.
those enemy soldiers that have already surrendered
mm-hmm.
and are under your custody,
mm-hmm.
and those criminal acts committed against the civilians,
mm-hmm.
Civilian population that mm-hmm. came under your control.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And
yes.
And then crimes
Turning to crimes against humanity, there is overlap between war crimes and crimes against humanity. But the crimes against humanity, as it is understood now as well as then, is mainly about the systematic attack targeted specifically on the civilian population.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not war is armed conflict is in progress.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The novelty of this concept, crimes against humanity, was that the law pertaining this category of offense would be applicable not only to enemy nationals,
mm-hmm.
but also to your own nationals.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Another novelty which I should emphasize as well is that whether armed conflict is in progress or not doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Whereas in order for war crimes to be established, there has to be first the context of war.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The benefits, the strengths, the important thing about crimes against humanity is that by using this concept, you could prosecute someone, say the leaders of Nazi Germany,
mm-hmm.
for committing systematic attack on Jewish people mm-hmm. of the German nationality,
mm-hmm.
whether or not there was an armed conflict or not.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, I see. And so under these three headers, the Allies put together an international tribunal. So let's talk a little bit about how they decided who was going to be party to the prosecution, because obviously it's the case that the United States was one party, but there were other parties as well. And who were they?
Are you talking about the defense?
No, you're talking about the prosecution, who the tribunal itself.
Sure. There are 11 countries that took part in the Tokyo proceedings,
mm-hmm.
plus Japan.
Mm-hmm.
These 11 nations were countries. Those countries that had been at war with Japan.
Mm-hmm. I see. So they were all invited. That would be the Russians and the Commonwealth nations and Australia and so on and so forth were all party to this.
Yes. I should add to this that among the 11
mm-hmm.
were major Asian powers such
mm-hmm.
as China,
mm-hmm.
India, and the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
It's particularly interesting that India and the Philippines were allowed to take part in the Tokyo proceedings because at the time of the commencement of the trial, these countries had not achieved independence.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, that is interesting. Yeah.
So there's some thoughts among the great powers like Britain and the United States to set the stage for these countries to have a greater say in international relations
mm-hmm.
in the post-war setup,
mm-hmm.
apparently.
Yeah. That is interesting. I didn't really realize that from reading the book. Let's turn now to the defendants. And again, this is going to appear to be a very ignorant question, but was it the case that upon defeating the Japanese forces and occupying Japan, that the occupying power or powers in this case, especially the United mm-hmm. States, just rounded up the leaders of the Japanese military and political authorities and put them in prison in Tokyo? How did they get all of these
yes.
people?
Yes, you're very right about it. I just add a few explanatory comments
mm-hmm.
to that. As I pointed out earlier, the Tokyo War Crimes Trial, the The main purpose of it was to prosecute wartime Japanese leaders for the crime of aggression.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a series of specific orders from the U.S. State Department, or it might have been, I think it was the State Department, to the occupation authorities in Tokyo to arrest those individuals who are considered as major suspects for
mm-hmm.
this type of offense.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really not everyone who held the highest positions in the Japanese government and
mm-hmm.
military establishment.
Mm-hmm.
It's those individuals who, in the evidence gathered so far,
mm-hmm.
may have played a key role in waging aggressive war against China and the other Western powers
mm-hmm.
In the Pacific region.
Mm-hmm. And how many people were arrested?
In total, there are 100, about 100 individuals
mm-hmm.
who were arrested and put into a prison called a particular prison known as the Sugamo prison,
mm-hmm.
or put under house arrest on grounds that they are the major suspects
mm-hmm.
To be considered for the Tokyo trial.
Was it easy to apprehend them, or did some of them try to go into hiding?
Yeah, the Japanese were more or less compliant.
Oh.
The situation is really different from what you see, say, in the former Yugoslavia,
mm-hmm.
where people are like hiding and,
mm-hmm.
You know, the arrest effort has been very difficult. The
mm-hmm.
governments are not necessarily cooperative and
mm-hmm.
so forth.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of Japan, the government was cooperating, and those identified as major suspects, they were also cooperative.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few instances of attempted suicide and successful suicide.
Mm-hmm.
Tojo Hideki was one of those who tried to
mm-hmm.
commit suicide but failed in the attempt.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Another major suspect who was a wartime prime minister three times, Prince Konoe.
Mm-hmm.
He committed suicide on the day before he was supposed to show up
mm-hmm.
At Sugamo prison.
Mm-hmm.
But given this barrage of wartime propaganda about self-sacrifice
mm-hmm.
and, you know, not to be not to surrender to the enemy
mm-hmm.
but choose death, the suicide rate, I must say, is quite low.
Yes, you point that out in the book, and I remarked on it as well. What did the people who were apprehended think was going to happen to them?
They probably aware. I think they are aware that war crimes trials of one kind or another would be happening
mm-hmm.
because by the time Japan accepted surrender, the four great powers in Europe, Britain, United States, Soviet Union, and France, had issued the declaration of establishing the Nuremberg Tribunal.
Mm-hmm.
So they must know that something like this may be created
mm-hmm.
in the Far East.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know to what extent they are knowledgeable about the
mm-hmm.
the specifics of charges that might be brought against them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I, the reason I ask is that I know, or at least I have read, that in the case of the period before the Nuremberg Tribunal, some of the high Nazis felt that they would be asked by the Allied powers and the British and the Americans specifically to lead the new Germany. I know Himmler was famous for saying things of this sort.
Uh-huh.
So that wasn't the case in Japan?
I'm not so sure. Let's say Prince Konoe, who
mm-hmm.
committed suicide, he was thinking that he may get a chance to lead New Japan.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And was kind of making mental preparation for
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
So for him to be named as a war crime suspect was a big shock.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So and there also was an attempt by the Japanese government to proceed with its own war crimes prosecution preempting the Allied war crimes program, but that was not allowed.
I see. Yeah, so, I see. So it's not the case, or I think you point out that it's not the case that of these 100 suspects, I guess we should call them, or detainees, that all of them were put on trial. How did they decide who was going to be tried and who wasn't?
Yes, the prosecutors, they tried to choose a group of about 20, who could be reasonably tried in a reasonable amount of time following the Nuremberg precedent. So the group of 20 or so, they decided should be a group of representatives, those who represented major key organs, key decision-making organs of the government and the military in the making of the Japanese war effort. That was one principle that dictated the selection process. They also tried to get one individual to cover as many different government and military offices and organs as possible, so that the idea of representation would be fully expressed in the chosen group. Furthermore, the prosecutors wanted this group to have such individuals who may be who could be linked to some instances of mass atrocity, such as the rape of Nanking in 1937, or the rape of Manila in early 1945.
I found this part of the book very interesting because, generally speaking. I'm not a lawyer and don't know a lot about the law, but we prosecute people on the basis of individual responsibility. It seems like they used a very different technique here, that being people who were representative somehow. Were there any objections to that at the time? Did people say, you know, this is not consistent with our principles?
There must have been, but given the precedent already in place at Nuremberg, the thinking of the prosecution seems to have been that they just follow the example.
I see.
Moreover, the Tokyo trial was not an ordinary trial. There are hundreds of other criminal proceedings that are taking place in the Pacific region, which focus on really in a strict sense of the word individual responsibility of individual war crime suspects. The Tokyo trial was like Nuremberg. It's not about establishing the responsibility of individuals for specific offenses. It's also about setting the historical record straight. It's about getting as much documentation as possible about the Japanese war effort and the Japanese conduct of war. So that's one big reason why this idea of joint trial shaped the prosecutorial effort at Tokyo and Nuremberg.
I see. Well, that's actually a good segue or transition to my next series of questions. I'm glad that you mentioned setting the historical record straight, because one of the things that you describe is in creating the case against this group of leaders, the prosecution created, for some reason, a kind of fiction that there was a conspiracy that went back to 1931. I thought it was interesting because in the Nazi case, you can reasonably say that there was a kind of conspiracy because there is continuity of government in the Nazi case. But here, I mean, there wasn't continuity of government. So mm-hmm. how did they come to think that they needed to do it in this way?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a very complicated question, I have to say. At Nuremberg, as you say, at Nuremberg, the prosecutions tried to use this concept of the legal doctrine of criminal conspiracy
mm-hmm.
To establish the record of the German war effort.
Mm-hmm.
But the judges didn't like this idea very much. So they gave a very narrow interpretation of what criminal conspiracy meant. They only focused on the actual planning of actual war effort.
Mm-hmm.
And then the planning for the waging of aggressive war. And when and they look at whether individual defendants were present or had any active part in the planning of waging aggressive war.
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, they had they interpreted conspiracy to mean simply planning.
Mm-hmm.
But
I was going to say, even by that narrow definition of conspiracy, it doesn't apply very well at all to the Japanese case, does it?
Right. So the judgment at Tokyo with the conspiracy charge was quite problematic because the judgment was based on some visions by right-wing ideologues, or however you call it, about the establishment of Japanese hegemony in Asia,
mm-hmm.
Using such various statements by such ideologues,
mm-hmm.
Pretty much the tribunal established that yes, there was a conspiracy for the planning and waging of aggressive war,
mm-hmm.
and that those who subscribed to this idea was culpable.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the Tokyo Tribunal did. At Nuremberg, the judges said, yes, there was Hitler writing about, this grand vision of
mm-hmm.
German leadership in Europe, etc., but it's just a vision.
Mm-hmm.
And we are interested in actual planning.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So in terms of judgment, the Nuremberg one is more intellectually sound?
Yes, intellectually sound, yes.
Than that is at Tokyo.
Yeah. I think that it's funny because although I'm not an expert on Asian history, I've had to teach a little bit of it in 20th century history classes, and usually the way that it's taught and inscribed in American textbook is in fact as a kind of conspiracy that started in 1931 in Japan to create this greater East Asian co-prosperity sphere. But I was very interested to read in the book that it's much more difficult to actually knit together the various acts that were perpetrated by the Japanese government between 1931 and 1945, mm-hmm. that in fact it was much more ad hoc than that.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about the Tokyo judgment is that on the one hand, it says that as a general ruling that yes, there was a grand conspiracy to wage aggressive war to create this greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, when you read the specific findings of the tribunal
mm-hmm.
about the Japanese war effort, it doesn't read like a grand conspiracy. It's a planning of revising, canceling
mm-hmm.
of various war plans.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this discrepancy, in other words.
I was going to say, what it kind of reminds me of is the way that the Holocaust, that is the German genocide against the Jews, used to be described before we actually looked at all the documents. And people would say that, somehow this was in the German soul, or they would say Hitler had thought it up. And you can find it in uh-huh. Mein Kampf, or that it was decided in 1939 in the invasion uh-huh. of Poland. But actually, when you look at the documents themselves, there was just this kind of vague general sense that they had a discomfort, even an extreme discomfort, with what they called the Jewish problem, and never really had any sort of coordinated plan to start a genocidal campaign. And even when they did start, it was put together in a very ad hoc fashion. So I saw an interesting parallel there. Let me return to the question of setting the record straight. One of the fascinating things that you point out in the book is that the American, who I guess was the head of the tribunal, Keenan was his name, is that right? He wasn't really the right person for the job, I think we would say. Maybe you could talk a little bit about him.
Yes, one really interesting thing about the Tokyo trial is American leadership, or the lack thereof. The United States made it its policy to pursue a prosecutorial effort against the Nazi Germany, the leadership of Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan, with the emphasis on establishing the criminal responsibility for aggressive war. And the United States was consistent about pursuing this policy at both tribunals. But when it comes to sending in American staff to these two tribunals, the United States seemed more concerned about the success of Nuremberg than Tokyo. So at Nuremberg, you have the best, among the best legal minds of the United States at the time being represented at Nuremberg, say Justice Robert Jackson, who was a Supreme Court judge then, and was a key person really in planning for the Nuremberg trials. His Eastern counterpart was Joseph Keenan, who was the chief of a criminal division of some sort in the Justice Department. So in terms of the his career background, he was not as great as Justice Jackson. In terms of his leadership quality, he didn't quite show that well at Tokyo. In fact, his inability to lead was a big problem in the prosecution's teamwork.
I was going to say, one of the things you point out is that he was an alcoholic, and he was an untreated alcoholic, and this affected his performance.
Apparently so. It's in the prosecution team's internal memos. Keenan, who had been addicted to alcohol, had stopped drinking about a year before joining the Tokyo proceedings or something. But once in Japan, he started drinking, which created some concerns among his American staff. Other allied members were suspecting that, there was something wrong with this man, but they couldn't really do much about it. They weren't quite clear what was happening, and so on and so forth. But yes, so it's really an interesting topic that is to look at why the United States made so much commitment to sending the right kind of person to Nuremberg on the one hand, and not doing the same with Tokyo.
That is interesting. Maybe you can take a PhD student and have them write a dissertation on that. It's a good topic.
I think the big, but the big thing is really this. Nuremberg was a historic trial, whereas Tokyo was not. I mean, it was a historic one, but it was a follow-up. So I think that the idea of Tokyo being follow-up may partly explain the relative lack of commitment on the side of the United States to Tokyo. This is not to say, though, that there was an American leadership in terms of the number of people that the United States sent in and the number of talented people actually the United States did send, but who worked under Keenan. The commitment of the United States was the greatest. But without the help from 10 other allied nations who, that also sent in staff, the Tokyo trial may have ended far less not as good as it did.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, no, that makes sense. Again, to return to this topic of setting the record straight, that one of the things you point out about Keenan, if I remember correctly, is that he was much more interested in interviewing the suspects than he was in collecting documents. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. This is because of his understanding that at the end of war, at the end of World War II, the Japanese government made a systematic effort to destroy as many military records as possible,
mm-hmm.
In order to avoid Allied confiscation.
Mm-hmm.
In Germany, the German government or the military really didn't have much time for document destruction,
mm-hmm.
because there was already a Allied landing,
mm-hmm.
Approaching Germany.
Mm-hmm.
With respect to the Japanese war effort, I mean, Japan proper was more or less intact.
Mm-hmm.
There was no land invasion.
Mm-hmm.
It was expected, but it wasn't happening yet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So without the presence of the Allied forces, the Japanese government had the time to engage in systematic document destruction.
Mm-hmm.
Moreover, those outer islands that had formerly been still under Japanese control,
mm-hmm.
I mean, those pockets, the huge pockets of Japanese-occupied territories that had been saved of Allied attack. These islands could also carry out the government orders for
mm-hmm.
document destruction.
Mm-hmm.
So these things really affected, created problems in the subsequent Allied effort of war crimes investigations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see, yeah. So let's move directly to the trial itself. One of the defendants whom one might expect to be there was not there, and that was Emperor Hirohito. Why did they decide not to prosecute him?
It's a very important question. From the Allied leaders' point of view, Hirohito was a key suspect, as you just said, but they also see him as a special kind of war crime suspect. He was not only a legal problem, but also a political and military problem because of his very unique power and authority
mm-hmm.
as the Emperor of Japan.
Mm-hmm.
So on the one hand, there is a thinking that this person cannot escape criminal responsibility. But on the other hand, there was thinking that if the Allies proceed with his prosecution, there may be far-reaching political and military repercussions.
Mm-hmm.
So they went very cautiously as to what kind of policy to adopt vis-a-vis
mm-hmm.
Hirohito.
Mm-hmm.
The final decision that they adopted was to take no action, no commitment,
mm-hmm.
as of now, in favor of or against his trial.
Mm-hmm.
This policy of non-commitment was set in place as far back as the time of the Japanese acceptance of surrender
mm-hmm.
in the summer of 1945
mm-hmm.
and continued really till the very end of the Allied occupation. That's April 1952.
Mm-hmm.
That's my reading of the
mm-hmm.
sources.
Mm-hmm.
The treatment of Hirohito, I might add, is... the controversy surrounding his treatment is very much like what we confront today, for example, with the treatment of Sudanese President
mm-hmm.
Al-Bashir.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a huge international support for his prosecution, at least in this side of the world.
Mm-hmm.
But there are many cautionary words stated, even among us, about the idea of actually arresting and prosecuting him,
mm-hmm.
Because there would be far-reaching implications about treating this man. He's, again, like Hirohito, he's a very special kind of person.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I see. So then let's move to the trial directly. You have some very interesting things to say about the presentation of the prosecution's case, which seemed very convincing. But the most fascinating part to me was the fact that the defense was, I guess the word that comes to mind is sort of lackluster. That the defense was not vigorous as it was in Nuremberg. Why was that?
Yes, this is a very important point. Tokyo, as we just covered earlier, crimes against peace was the centerpiece of the prosecutorial effort. But there was a prosecutorial effort concerning war crimes and crimes against humanity.
Mm-hmm.
With substantiation and the rebuttal of the charges related to crimes against peace, the defense was very aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was a matter of determining whether it was just war or not.
Mm-hmm.
So defense was actually quite robust.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to the prosecution's evidence on war crimes, the defense effort was, you might say, rather poor.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the defense position was to accept the prosecution's contention that there was widespread perpetration of war crimes by the Japanese armed forces.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So when such evidence, evidence after evidence being brought before the prosecution mm-hmm. about the mistreatment of POWs, death marches, summary execution, rape, torture, and so forth,
mm-hmm.
the defense was largely quiet.
The
point that the defense did contest was the responsibility of the individual defendants
mm-hmm.
for the occurrence of the widespread atrocities.
Yeah, at some point I remember reading that they also attempted to say that in the case of the atrocities in China in the early 1930s, they said that the nationalist Chinese forces were doing the same thing and that this would somehow mitigate their guilt.
Right.
One of the things you point out is that now the Japanese attorneys or lawyers who were charged with presenting the defense had American assistance, but they themselves didn't really understand the procedure very well, did they?
Well, the Japanese defense lawyers, many of whom are actually not lawyers, they didn't quite understand how the adversarial system of the Anglo-American legal tradition worked. In order to make up for their lack of experience in a different type of legal system, the Japanese government requested the Allied assistance.
Mm-hmm.
And the United States agreed to send in American lawyers
mm-hmm.
To assist the Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
So much of the defense argument was presented by the American lawyers.
I see. Yeah. Is it your general feeling that it was very effective?
Appearance, that is to say, from the Japanese viewpoint, the ordinary Japanese people, they seem to have thought that the American presence in the Defense Council was really important
mm-hmm.
to give the Tokyo trial some degree of appearance of fair trial.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the effectiveness, it's something that I should really look into.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the number of American lawyers provided, it's quite limited, about
mm-hmm.
2 dozen or so.
Mm-hmm.
So the defense was always suffering from shortage of staff.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of Japanese people helping,
mm-hmm.
but English-speaking staff was lacking.
Mm-hmm.
But if we can come back to the defense efforts regarding war crimes,
mm-hmm.
charges of war crimes.
Yeah.
It seems it's less the lack of staff affected the defense effort.
Mm-hmm.
It's really the how compelling the prosecution's evidence
mm-hmm.
that really made the defense effort difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Defense
mm-hmm.
effort to rebut.
Mm-hmm. And so then maybe you could just describe briefly, after all the evidence was presented and the defense presented its case, what did the court rule?
The court's finding was that indeed, as the prosecution had argued, the judgment goes, I mean, it's not literal, there was compelling evidence of widespread war crimes
mm-hmm.
committed by the Japanese armed forces,
mm-hmm.
and that given how widespread the war crimes were and how similarly patterned these war crimes were, it's inconceivable to think that the Japanese leaders of the Japanese government and military were totally unaware of these.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the tribunal goes, the members of the Japanese government and the military must have known, at the least,
mm-hmm.
or may have secretly ordered mm-hmm. that these crimes be committed.
Mm-hmm.
The word secret is quite interesting and important here because it points to the prosecution's great difficulty in presenting documentary evidence of actual criminal orders or
mm-hmm.
authorizations.
Mm-hmm.
It leads to the Japanese government's effort of obstructionism
mm-hmm.
at the end of war.
Mm-hmm.
That is the systematic destruction of documents.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This is not to say that there are no such orders or authorization to commit war crimes.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, recent research by Japanese scholars bringing to light some documentary evidence of, say, the Tojo cabinet authorizing the use of Chinese POWs as slave labor,
mm-hmm.
For forced labor,
mm-hmm.
or the Japanese government and the military authorizing the use of women for the covered women.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that the document destruction was completely, it was totally effective, but that as of the 1946 through 48, when the Tokyo trial took place, the prosecution didn't manage to secure relevant documents.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see. So then what sentences were meted out by the court?
There are 25 defendants.
Mm-hmm.
Out of 25, 10 were found guilty of war crimes.
Mm-hmm.
Other 15 were not. They were acquitted or not charged of war crimes anyway, but many of them were acquitted. But they did receive conviction with respect to crimes against peace. So everyone was convicted. But it was those 10 who were convicted of war crimes who received the harshest punishment.
Mm-hmm.
7 of 10 received a death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
The remaining 3 varying terms of imprisonment.
Mm-hmm. I see. So let's talk a little bit about, you mentioned this earlier, but Powell's dissenting opinion. What exactly did he say about the judgment or the jurisdiction of the tribunal?
Yes, his greatest dissent was the idea of aggressive war as constituting an international offense.
Mm-hmm.
In his reading of international body of international law, he argued that such idea could not was untenable.
Mm-hmm.
He was also of the opinion that the doctrine of command responsibility that was broadly applied in the case at Tokyo, as well as at other Allied war crimes trials,
mm-hmm.
Was problematic.
I see.
Mm-hmm. He didn't reject the idea, but with respect to the accused at Tokyo,
mm-hmm.
he concluded that no one could be convicted on this on the basis of this doctrine.
Hmm.
But the greatest dissent he had was international law itself.
Mm-hmm.
He had this idea that international law as applied at Tokyo, this was a product of the Western civilization.
Mm-hmm.
And that him being a great believer of other kind of law with capital L,
mm-hmm.
Ruling the Asian civilization,
mm-hmm.
and which was the superior one,
mm-hmm.
he just couldn't subscribe to the idea of applying this law.
Mm-hmm. I see.
So that's the greatest, really, dissent
mm-hmm.
that he had.
And did this opinion find favor among the Japanese public after the war?
That's right. Yes, very much so. And it's his dissenting opinion that is regarded as the judgment,
mm-hmm.
and it's in fact not referred to as Judge Pao's dissenting opinion.
Mm-hmm.
It's referred to as Pao's judgment.
Oh, really? Is that right?
Right.
So is he something of a national hero then? Is there a stamp in Japan with his picture on it or anything?
Yeah, he's the Yasukuni Shrine, which is a major war memorial site in Japan today,
mm-hmm.
where 2.5 war dead is enshrined.
Mm-hmm.
Within the precinct, you can now find a stone monument
mm-hmm.
Of Pao
mm-hmm.
commemorating his great
dissenting
opinion.
That's just tremendously interesting. Anyway, Yuma Tatani, we have taken up really a lot of your time, and we're very grateful for it. Let me close the interview by asking our traditional final question, and that is, what is your next project? What are you working on now?
I would like to continue working on the Tokyo trial, because what I produce here only looks at the tip of the iceberg, really.
Mm-hmm.
The trial records being so massive, and given my time, which was about 2 to 3 years
mm-hmm.
in my graduate, as
mm-hmm.
a graduate student, I really couldn't go through all documents.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lifetime job, really.
Well, I was going to say, you're lucky to have a lifetime job. A lot of us have to pick different topics, because I know in my case, I completely exhausted the kind of sources that I was looking at.
I doubt it.
Yeah. So anyway, well, I want to thank you very much for being on the show. I'll tell our audience again that we've been talking to Yuma Tatani about her new book, her terrific new book, The Tokyo War Crimes Trial, The Pursuit of Justice in the Wake of World War II. So thanks for being on the show, Yumi. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Yuma Tatani about her new book, The Tokyo War Crimes Trial, The Pursuit of Justice in the Wake of World War II. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.